You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future. From research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. Today, I am super excited to be speaking with my guest, Christine Motokani. The theme of today's podcast is discussing Christine's experience with ABA and what it's like living as an adult with autism. Christine is an autistic self-advocate. She graduated with honors from Loyola Marymount University with a BA in psychology. Currently, she's employed as a special education paraeducator, helping high school students with developmental disabilities. In 2014, Christine wrote an autobiography titled Working the Double Shift, A Young Woman's Journey with Autism. She has spoken about her experiences with various groups and organizations and at conferences. Her goal is to spread autism acceptance and to educate others about the need to create a variety of supports and opportunities for adults with autism and other developmental disabilities in the areas of employment, post-secondary education, housing, and social and recreational activities. I'm delighted to welcome Christine Motokani to the program. Welcome, Christine.
Thank you, Ronit. It's so nice to be on this podcast.
Christine, you recently wrote a blog about the divide between self-advocates and parents, which I'd love to discuss. But what you focused on in that blog was applied behavior analysis, what we call ABA, which is the science and the technology that we use to teach autistic kids. And I'd love to understand more about the self-advocacy movement. You know, there's a very strong self-advocacy movement where autistic adults are very outspoken about ABA. Many of them are very negative. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, on one hand, I do understand the self-advocate's perspective because ABA was based on like a very abusive background, like back in the day, because, you know, practitioners actually forced the children to comply with their directions. And it was really abusive. Like they would actually put their hands on the child, like treat them like animals. And the goal was back in the 80s to make the child as normal as possible so they don't have to be institutionalized. So that's where the thing called recovered comes from. But, you know, people who got ABA as kids, a lot of them are growing up, like they're in their 20s and 30s, and they're saying they got traumatized by this therapy. So that's why a lot of self-advocates are against ABA. But ABA is not the only therapy out there. And there's things that are called ABA, but they're not. They only do that because of insurance purposes. Like there's like the Denver model, there's pivotal response training, and there's different forms. And then there's things called floor time and relationship development intervention, and that's a behavior technique. But I think in my experience, ABA has helped me teach, like learn self-regulation. It taught me coping and life skills so I could get through college and get a job. But I would have to say it didn't cure my autism. I still struggle with autism and anxiety to this day. But the goal should be to optimize the child's life so they could have a happy life as much as possible.
What do you think about this concept of recovery? You know, some providers will advertise recovery on their websites. What do you think about that concept?
I think it's a little bit misleading because what if a parent, they hope that their kid will get recovered, but then so many years goes by and they're still autistic? Because I know people on the spectrum that go through ABA and they're still pretty heavily impacted by autism. So I think it's pretty misleading to families to say that they could cure autism. And that's why a lot of self-advocates get angry about that, because it feels like it's like a money scheme.
Right. I think there's that perspective of it feeling like a money scheme, but there's also the other perspective. A lot of self-advocates who I've talked to have said, you know, this is who I am. I was born this way. I don't know my way. I don't know myself a different way. And the thought that I need to be cured from being who I am really makes me angry. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with that. Autism is a part of a person. You can't really cure autism. It's kind of unrealistic because it's deep in the genes for the most part. There might be some environmental different things. I don't want to go down that whole road down because that's not what this podcast is about. Yeah, but you can't take the autism out of the person. And I always believe that. And I feel like if people recovered from autism, that probably mean they probably were not autistic in the first place.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. You mentioned earlier that, you know, a lot of people say they do ABA. It's not true ABA. And you also referenced, you know, the ABA from the 80s, you know, when Lovaas first started promoting ABA for autism. And, you know, certainly a lot of the ABA today is a more contemporary, more modern ABA that takes a very family-focused approach, looks at the needs of the family and the needs of the person. They don't use aversive procedures. A lot of it is, you know, skill building and helping people adapt. So I know you had two different agencies that you worked with when you were a teenager. Can you speak to those two different experiences with ABA?
Yeah. So when I was in middle school, there was an agency that would come into the school and they would watch me and observe me and work with me. But it only made me more anxiety provoking because they had actually a goal that says that I would not jump up and down anymore. And they treated it like a behavior rather than a sensory issue. Like the jumping was inherently bad. That's where the stim suppression that a lot of self-advocates really hated. So at the end of my eighth grade year at my IEP meeting, in eighth grade, I started working with a private behaviorist and she looked at the IEP and she said, well, she's doing it because she has it's a sensory need. It's not because of behavior. Like they shouldn't write that goal to say she needs to recover from autism without having a replacement, you know?
So can you help our listeners understand self-stimulatory behaviors and what that does for you, how that helps you?
So self-stimulatory behaviors are behaviors like rocking, flapping, making noises. It ranges a whole gamut. There's vocal stimming. There's repeating phrases over and over again. But it's used as a coping mechanism to deal with the input they're getting from an outside world that's overwhelming. So it's a natural way without going into a full-blown meltdown.
So it serves a function. It helps you to discharge energy, to kind of calm anxiety and to manage the overwhelm that you're getting from sensory overwhelm from external stimuli.
Yes.
So tell me about your second experience with the second ABA agency. You said that she really helped you with emotion regulation and going into the community, and she gave you skills that really built the foundation for you to go to college. Can you share more about that?
Yeah, but she wasn't really an agency. It was a private individual. She would come to my house once a week, and she would teach me coping skills, and she had a very visual way to teach me emotional regulation. Ever heard of the zone of regulation curriculum?
Yes.
So there's green would be calm, yellow would be a little bit stressed out, and red would be very angry and stressed out. She gave me a visual, and then sometimes we would go outings into community and to different volunteer sites and to see what I would want to do. And then she also taught me self-advocacy skills and self-awareness and self-determination, getting to know myself and what I need so I could be able to tell other people what I need.
So tell us a little bit about your college experience, you know, and the good parts and some of the challenges that you experienced.
College was hard. I started at a community college because I didn't want to take the SATs right out of high school and go to a four-year. I just felt a shock because I lost all the services that I had with an IEP, because an IEP, you had the one-on-one aid, you had a lot of people working with you, school counselors, behaviorists, you had a lot of support. But then when you get a diploma, which can happen at 18 or 22, 21, depending what route the kid goes on, you lose all that support. It's called falling off the cliff. And then in college, you don't have an IEP. They basically just have a disability center, and you could get accommodations like extended time on tests or a note taker, but they're all generic, but they don't go beyond that. Like, they don't provide the emotional and social support that most people on the spectrum need. So I struggled first 2 to 3 years of community college trying to navigate it and dealing with my emotions, because academically I did really well. It was the social emotional part that was overwhelming, and I just felt like dropping out.
And something you mentioned to me when we talked a couple of years ago was that you had some social skills training. You know, you went through social skills workshops as a teen, but that didn't really help you with friendships and relationships in college. Can you explain why the skills that you learned didn't translate for you?
Because it's not generalized. It only happens in like a group, and like you could probably get 45 minutes to an hour. And it's basically somebody saying, oh, and they do role playing and they go, oh, Joey did this. What did Joey did wrong? And that was the psychological damage, because it's like you're saying, what did this person do wrong? Instead of like, how can you improve the next time? And the thing about social skills training, you got to be very motivated to be participating in that group. And it only helps if people are socially awkward versus socially anxious. There's a difference between the two.
What is the difference between those two?
Social awkwardness is like you don't really have the skills. Like you don't really are not aware of what common social norms are. That's where social skills training could probably help in some extent. But again, it doesn't generalize to different environments. It doesn't really help you where the problem is. Social anxiety, on the other hand, is you could have the skills, but you're just afraid. Like there's like this voice internally telling you, oh, they're going to hate you and do this and that. It's like social anxiety disorder.
Okay. And so you're saying that social skills groups help more the socially awkward, but not the social anxiety.
Yeah, the socially anxious.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I've actually never heard that distinction before. So thank you for explaining that. In your blog, you also talked about the divide between, you know, parents of kids with autism and kids or self-advocates. Can you speak a little bit more? Was that more about the divide between some parents wanting their kids to be cured and other parents just wanting to support their kids?
Well, there's this divide because people just really care to make sure everybody's voice gets represented. But it's just different because autism is such a wide spectrum. Like there's people who are, quote, I don't like using that term, high functioning. And then there's kids who are fairly severely disabled by autism. So parents say, well, you can advocate for yourself because you're high functioning. But you don't know what it's like to live with a kid who is violent, who can't express their needs well, really well, who probably might be in a diaper or poop smearing and all that other stuff. So they tell the self-advocates that. But the problem is both sides could get very hostile towards each other. Like there's parents who accuse self-advocates as being, oh, you're faking, you don't really have autism. Like you don't have real autism. And then there's self-advocates, like what happened, I gave that example on my blog, that accused that one family of abusing their child because they put them in ABA, when it's really just the therapist was just teaching her life skills, and I saw nothing abusive about it. And they're calling, you're being abusing your kid because you want to cure them. And they said, autism is not a disability, it's just a difference. And they're against all therapeutic intervention.
Yeah, I understand that. Christine, help us understand what splinter skills are. You've talked about splinter skills in the past.
Okay, so splintered skills. You know how people with intellectual disability, if their cognitive ability is a little, they're pretty much like their other skills will be the same level, like probably learning like their academic level will probably match like their in the, their adaptive skills, like independent living skills. But with our autism, their skills could be all over the place. Like someone could remember, you know, facts about trains or different dates, but they cannot tie their own shoes and they probably cannot live independently. And they could probably have a good visual memory and they could remember, you know, stuff that happened so many years ago. That's me. But there are certain things that are hard for me, like fine motor skills. I need help with cooking. Driving is pretty hard because I'm worried about the attention span.
Interesting. So, you know, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that the high functioning, right? This label of high functioning. And I've spoken to a number of people who've said to me that, you know, autism can be an invisible disability. Just because somebody looks like they're coping doesn't mean that they're actually coping well or that they're able to cope in a lot of environments. So help us understand why this, you know, label, for lack of a better word, high functioning does such a disservice.
Because it dismisses real struggles and the real support needs of these individuals. You know, a lot of people labeled high functioning, it's really hard for them to get services like Medicaid waivers in some states. And the state I just moved to is one of them. California is kind of different because it has like a wider eligibility criteria when it comes to like getting regional center or, you know, having personal care services or attendance services, whatever.
Right. So you mentioned your move to Washington State and how that was really challenging for you because it was so hard to get supports and services. Can you share a little bit about that?
Well, luckily, I did end up getting eligible for the waiver. And that is because a long time ago, I was diagnosed with classic autism. And in Washington State, they said if you meet the DSM-4 criteria of having classic autism, you could get services. But I had to jump through all these hoops, like financial hoops, just to get on this waiver.
And that took quite a long time, right?
Yeah. But if you have Asperger's or level 1 autism under the DSM-5, you will not be able to get services in this state. And I'm not sure about how it is in other states. But all I know is in Washington, it's really hard for people who have high-functioning forms of autism and those who are diagnosed as adults to get services.
And now, of course, we have COVID happening, and there's a whole new layer of complexity there. Share with us how COVID and social distancing has affected you.
It's made things 10 times harder. Like everything's virtual and we can't do a lot of stuff because restaurants are closed. There's still a lot of shutdowns. And then for a lot of people, they're not getting paid supports right now because of social distancing and fears of getting COVID-19, especially if the support person works with a lot of vulnerable clients or that support person themselves, they care for somebody that's vulnerable or they're in that category. It's just a very sucky situation.
So how's it impacted you personally? I know that you mentioned to me that, you know, you've lost a lot of your transportation and the ability to do community outings or to have your support person drive you around. How's it, give us a sense of like day to day, how it's impacted you.
Well, yeah, that's an example. Like I work with this support person and she's getting paid by the waiver, but the agency told her she can't drive me because of COVID. And it's created a lot of inconveniences in my life because I'm just worried about work and how I'm going to get through all like life with COVID. And it's just, it's very inconvenient, but I have another person who's like a respite provider and she's able to drive me around because she's not affiliated with an agency. Like she's kind of like an independent provider.
Well, that's great that you have that. You mentioned to me that, you know, this work should be considered an essential service, right? It hasn't been deemed an essential service, but that really the impact on mental health and anxiety and depression and isolation is so severe that this should be deemed an essential service.
Yeah. Because some people, they cannot get their needs met over a telephone call or Zoom call, especially if they need help with personal care. And for people like me, you need emotional support. And it's just, there's only so much a Zoom call can do. But it's not the same like how you would get in a face-to-face, in-person, like setting.
Right. And you mentioned also something about mask wearing, that it's really, for people who have sensory issues, that's a challenge. Can you speak to that a little bit, please?
Yeah, that's wearing masks for a long period of time. It's really tough because the cloth that most masks are made, it's uncomfortable to on the face. And it's like it's a sensory nightmare. And it's like hard to wear for a long period of time. And if you're going to work or you're going to school, a lot of policies require that you wear a mask for like the whole day. Like I'm able to adjust to that, but there's so many people on the spectrum that can't, because they're going to say, well, I don't like the feel of this mask, so therefore I'm going to take it off. Like they'll just take it off.
So that further complicates, you know, having support staff with individuals because they might be exposed, right? The whole situation is quite complicated.
Yeah, it's really complicated.
So, Christine, for ABA providers out there, what can you share, like the three things that helped you the most as a teenager when you were receiving services that really contributed to your ability to successfully graduate from college and now have a job? What are the three things that helped you the most?
Well, teaching emotional regulation skills, teaching self-advocacy, teaching empowering individuals on the spectrum that they have choices. Even if they can't get to the level like I can, like advocate on a very wide, complicated level, they could still advocate and have choice and be able to make choices. Like, what shirt you want to wear or what music do you want to listen to? Like just making them feel respected and, you know, finding ways to deal with the sensory scene, like maybe noise-canceling headphones, fidget.
Yeah, I think that's so important because if you look at the data on adults, the last data set I looked at, I think it's from 2017, but they said that fewer than 10% of adults with disabilities actually get to make choices like what they're going to eat in a day, what they're going to do, what their activities are going to be, who they're going to spend time with, right? We take that for granted that we get to make those choices, but a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
Well, Christine, I really appreciate you joining us on the podcast. I mean, I think you've been so generous with me over the years sharing your experiences. And I think the fact that you're out there advocating and speaking up really is educating people because, you know, a lot more people are aware of autism and what it means, but I don't think a lot of people get to hear from adults around how it impacts their ability to work and live in the world. And I think it's so important what you're doing. So I really appreciate you spending time with me today.
Oh, no problem.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Renit Molko. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.